Imagine, if you will, a long conference table around which sit 12 old soldiers. They range in age from 105 to 113. Some of these veterans are blind. Most have trouble hearing. 90 years ago, 4 million Americans served their country on the home front and on the battlefield during World War I. Of that number, these are the last surviving witnesses. I'm Walter Cronkite. Join me this hour as we honor the memories and experiences of these veterans on the World War I Living History Project. A century since Europe had seen a major military conflict. The Franco-Prussian War of 1870 still resounded in living memory. When one thought of war, the image that came to mind was a Napoleonic-style contest fought with cavalry and cannons. The object was to capture territory and subdue an enemy opponent. With the technology advances of the 20th century, however, a new form of warfare had emerged. It was swifter and bloodier than anything that had gone before. The airplane, the automobile, the submarine, and chemical weaponry had forever changed the manner by which grievances would be redressed on the battlefield.
General Stephen Burkheiser is executive director of the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri.
Nations were putting their whole economies, their whole energies, both in terms of scientific technological development into those things that were necessary to fight war on a global scale. You have the introduction of machine guns, for example, on a large scale, where a single machine gun might have the same effectiveness of 200 riflemen in a previous conflict. There was submarine warfare developing the tactics of economic strangulation. You could bring someone to their knees by stopping the flow of goods. Aviation, communications, and the scientific development of weapons that we would now call weapons of mass destruction.
The effects of such a conflict could only be imagined. What had not changed were the methods of international diplomacy. Centuries-old treaties bound the European powers in a complex tangle of alliances. These had been strained by regional conflicts and seething ambitions. The nations of Europe were in a race for great power supremacy. Each of the old monarchies, though often related by blood, vied to become the dominant land power on the continent. It was against the backdrop of accelerating technological and political change that on June 20th in Sarajevo, a Serbian nationalist named Gavril Princip assassinated Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. Political assassination was not new in the Balkans. What was new were the complex relationships that existed among the great powers. Austria used the incident as a pretext for waging war against Serbia, and it was prudent in seeking the support of its ally, Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm II offered Austria-Hungary his country's unconditional support. And so began a political chain reaction that swept through the capitals of Europe. When Austria sought the support of Germany, it was to protect itself from Serbia's formidable ally to the east, the mighty Russian army. Pledged to stand behind Russia was France, and pledged to France was Great Britain. Ultimatums were exchanged and armies were mobilized. No means of diplomacy existed to defuse the mounting tension. No mediator stepped in to avert the cataclysm that lay ahead. Exactly 1 month after the Archduke's assassination, the armies of Europe marched into war.
You probably can't find many World War I scholars who would say, these are the causes of World War I. But the one thing that they all seem to agree on is that it was absolutely a horrific diplomatic failing, that it really didn't have to happen. During the Vietnam War, There were popular expressions, what if somebody gave a war and nobody came? It's an interesting concept. But in the case of World War I, someone gave a war and everybody came. And they all thought it was going to be short, that there was going to be some glory, some spoils to be divided. But it wasn't that there were great war aims or a compelling case for anybody to have to go to war.
Lady Margaret Asquith, wife of Prime Minister Henry Asquith, recalls the night Great Britain entered the war.
After dinner, I joined my husband in the cabinet room. The windows were all open. We sat without speaking and listened to the distant sound of thousands and thousands of people singing and cheering outside the railings of Buckingham Palace. Then Big Ben struck. The crowd outside seemed to be singing and cheering everywhere. But inside the cabinet room, it was silent as dawn. I left to go to bed. We were at war.
Military strategists in Russia, Germany, and France had been preparing for this event decades before Gavrilo Princip fired into the Archduke's motorcade. France had formulated a plan which it believed would cripple German industry. Russia had a plan for how to handle a simultaneous assault from Germany and Austria-Hungary. But it was a German strategy that would determine the course and the nature of the Great War. Some 20 years before, Alfred von Schlieffen, the German Army Chief of Staff, had created a plan for how Germany could successfully fight a war on two fronts. The Schlieffen plan called for a quick, sweeping attack on France through Belgium. It would cripple the French army and allow Germany to concentrate its military might on the advancing Russian army in the east.
Dr. William Adams of the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
The Schlieffen plan is, typically Germanic. I mean, that was planned down to the day, to the hour. The number of trains, for instance, that were scheduled to bring up that army, I think it was 16,400 to be brought up in the 30 days. But the timetable needed to do that on the, using the German rail network was a piece of art, the way they had worked that out. And, of course, had Schlieffen's plan been followed, had they not modified it, I mean, it came within an ounce of succeeding as it was.
Schlieffen did not live to see the implementation of his strategy, nor did he see its failure as the German army encountered the stubborn resistance of the tiny Belgian army. With the arrival of the armies of France and Great Britain, the fighting deadlocked, moving from the battlefield to the trenches. And so it would be until the end of the war. Conceived as temporary shelters, these trenches would soon stretch some 500 miles from the Swiss frontier to the North Sea. The First World War would be characterized as a war of attrition. Gains were measured not in terms of miles, but of yards. Armies gathered in opposing trenches with the single goal of wearing down the manpower and reserves of the enemy. It was a slow, grinding method of warfare that would result in the death of millions. The trenches remain one of the lasting images of World War I. Here the soldiers lived, ate, slept, and fought in conditions that often defied the imagination.
We must look out for our bread. The rats have become much more numerous lately because the trenches are no longer in good condition. The rats here are particularly repulsive. They are so fat, the kind we call corpse rats. They have shocking, evil, naked faces, and it is nauseating to see their long, nude tails.
Whilst asleep during the night, we were frequently awakened by rats running over us. When this happened too often for my liking, I would lie on my back and wait for a rat to linger on my legs, then violently heave my legs upward, throwing the rat into the air. Occasionally I would hear a grunt when the rat landed on a fellow victim.
If you have never had a trench foot described to you, I will explain. Your feet swell 2 to 3 times their normal size and go completely dead. You can stick a bayonet into them and no feel a thing. It is then that the most incredible agony begins. I have heard men cry and scream with pain, and many have had to have their feet and leg amputated. I was one of the lucky ones, but one more day in that trench, and it may have been too late.
The water in the trenches through which we waded was alive with a multitude of swimming frogs. Red slugs crawled up the side of the trenches, and strange beetles with dangerous-looking horns wriggled along dry ledges and invaded the dugouts in search of the lice that infested them.
Modern recoil mechanisms allowed gunners to shoot off round after round in rapid succession. At the Battle of the Somme in July 1916, artillery crews fired at an incredible rate of 1 million shells a day. The losses on each side were incredible. On July 1st, the British Army saw the worst day in its history, with 19,000 dead in a single day. The conflict that was expected to end by Christmas had bogged down into what would be the bloodiest war yet seen in human history.
I suddenly heard a horrid hum and whiz close to my ear. As I went on, there were more hums from bullets, possibly overhead. My stretcher bearers were more shaken than I was even, and did not sleep a bit, but sat round a room in silence, hating the whole thing. We are all new to it, and I felt very sorry for them. At first, the zip-zip of bullets hitting the sandbags was rather disconcerting. Then it became just part of the general environs.
To break the stalemate, the Germans introduced the first chemical weapons in modern warfare. At the Belgian town of Ypres, a strange fog crept across no man's land toward the French trenches. Blinded and choking, the French retreated as more than 5,000 cylinders of chlorine gas were deployed. It opened up a hole in the Allied defense 4.5 miles long.
The gaseous vapor which the Germans used against the French divisions near Ypres last Thursday, contrary to the rules of the Hague Convention, introduces a new element into warfare. The attack of last Thursday evening was preceded by the rising of a cloud of vapor. That vapor settled to the ground like a swamp mist and drifted toward the French trenches on a brisk wind. Its effect on the French was a violent nausea and faintness, followed by an utter collapse. It is believed that the Germans who charged in behind the vapor met no resistance at all, the French at their front being virtually paralyzed.
Early use of gas was unreliable. The wind could carry it in any direction, killing friend and foe. But gas would later be deployed with greater accuracy by artillery shell. Soon, more lethal forms of chemical weaponry, such as phosgene and mustard gas, would be developed by both sides.
The effects of the noxious trench gas seemed to be slow in wearing away. The men came out of their nausea in a state of utter collapse. Some of the rescue have already died from the after effect. How many of the men left unconscious in the trenches die from the fumes? It is impossible to say, since those trenches were at once occupied by the Germans.
Another war was being fought on the home front. Nations mobilized their entire populations. The purpose was to keep their armies and navies supplied with weapons, ammunition, clothing, and food. Civilians became targets for enemy raids far behind the front lines. The Germans shelled French and Belgian cities with long-range artillery and bombarded Britain from battleships and Zeppelin airships. Britain's navy blockaded Germany, starving it of food and raw materials for its industry. Germany's solution to the blockade was unrestricted submarine warfare. It hoped to break the Allied home front before the German home front gave way. Thousands of tons of shipping went to the bottom of the ocean. Adolf von Spiegel commanded a German U-boat during the First World War. Here he describes the attack on a cargo vessel in April 1916.
The steamer appeared to be close to us and looked colossal, I saw the captain walking on his bridge, a small whistle in his mouth. I saw the crew cleaning the deck forward, and I saw, with surprise and a slight shudder, long rows of wooden partitions right along all decks, from which gleamed the shining black and brown backs of horses. Oh, heavens, horses! What a pity, those lovely beasts! But it cannot be helped. I went on thinking war is war, and every horse, the fewer on the Western Front, is a reduction in England's fighting power. I must acknowledge, however, the thought of what must come was a most unpleasant one.
Among the casualties was a ship of the Cunard line, the Lusitania, which was torpedoed off the coast of Ireland on May 7, 1915. 1,200 civilians perished, many of them women and children. Across the Atlantic, Americans were horrified. President Woodrow Wilson had maintained a policy of neutrality toward the war. But the German attacks on merchant shipping and the sinking of the Lusitania brought the war ever closer to American shores. Wilson's Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, condemned the German submarine attacks in no uncertain terms.
"We could not believe that Germany would do what she said she would do upon the seas. Yet we still hear the piteous cries of children coming out of the sea where the Lusitania went down. And Germany has never asked forgiveness of the world. We saw the Sussex sunk, crowded with the sons and daughters of neutral nations. We saw ship after ship sent to the bottom, ships of mercy bound out of America for the Belgian starving, ships carrying the Red Cross and laden with the wounded of all nations, murdered against all law without warning."
Germany suspended its policy of unlimited submarine warfare for a time, but by now the majority of Americans had sided with the cause of the Allied powers. It was helped in part by British and French propaganda aimed at stirring the United States, the sleeping giant, into action. Rumors began circulating of Germans parading through Belgian towns with babies on the ends of bayonets. One headline of the period read, "Germans crucify Canadian officer." President Wilson remained firm in his policy of neutrality. He cited George Washington's farewell address, in which he advised against getting involved in foreign entanglements. But many Americans felt differently. Between 1914 and 1917, some 15,000 young men and women slipped across the border. They joined the Canadian Army or signed up for the French Ambulance and Nursing Service, as did Ernest Hemingway, E.E. Cummings, and Gertrude Stein. For many medical volunteers, it was a brutal awakening to the realities of modern warfare.
A broken-down horse appeared with a cartload of what looked like old clothes. I'd never seen a dead body till that moment. It was a horrible awakening. 8 stiff, semi-detached, armless, trunkless, headless bodies. A grave had been dug 2 meters deep, large enough to hold 16. Then one by one they were lowered into the grave, and when they were all laid out, the identification started to take place, and the good boots were taken off, and if a coat was not too bloody or torn, it was kept.
On the Eastern Front, the well-trained German army dealt easily with the large but ill-equipped Russian army. In 1914, Russia had the largest army in the world, with 1.5 million men. But many were now fighting without arms or ammunition. At the Battle of Tannenberg in August 1914, a force of 150,000 was shattered. Only 10,000 Russian soldiers left the battlefield. With more and more civilians being conscripted into the Russian army, harvests failed and famine spread through the land. A monk and seer named Rasputin had warned Tsar Nicholas that if he entered the war, Russia would lose and the Romanov dynasty would come to an end. His prophecy would be borne out by the Bolshevik Revolution, a direct consequence of the bloodletting taking place along the Eastern Front. The armies of Europe remained in what looked like a permanent deadlock. The battle lines had changed scarcely at all since 1914, and still the war dragged on. Towns in France and Belgium would become synonymous with wholesale slaughter. At the Battle of the Somme in 1916, the British introduced the tank, but without significantly affecting the battle's 1 million casualties. Morale eroded within the ranks. At Verdun, more than 40,000 French infantrymen refused to fight. Penalties for mutiny and desertion were swift and severe.
The private of the South Staffordshire Regiment was tried on the following charges: misbehaving in such a manner as to show cowardice. The accused, when proceeding with a party for work in the trenches, ran away, owing to the bursting of a shell, and did not rejoin the party. The sentence of the court was to suffer death by being shot.
The spirit of dissent spread across both sides of the trenches. Camaraderie began to flourish between opposing forces. Realizing the futility of the eye-for-an-eye policy of attrition, they would sometimes seek to limit the casualties on both sides by signaling to each other before launching an assault, or they simply refused to fire. By 1917, 2.5 years after an assassin's bullet lit the powder keg that would become the First World War, there was no end in sight. The Bolshevik Revolution in February had taken Russia out of the war and relaxed Germany's Eastern Front. It allowed the Kaiser to send the bulk of his troops to tip the balance in the West. And yet the British naval blockade of Germany had left the Germans in desperate need of munitions and food. Events in Russia pointed to the possibility of revolution on the German home front. Germany's only option was to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. It was a policy which Germany knew would have immediate repercussions across the Atlantic.
The determination to launch the unrestricted U-boat war depends then upon the results which we may expect. Admiral von Holzendorf assumes that we will have England on her knees by next harvest. The experiences of the U-boats during the last few months, the increased number of U-boats, and England's bad economic situation will at least increase our chances of success. The U-boat war is a very serious question. We will have to calculate upon America's entrance into the war against us.
President Wilson had been re-elected the year before on the platform, "He kept us out of the war." Even in early 1917, Wilson vowed that America was too proud to fight. But as American merchant ships were sent to the bottom of the sea, both the interest and the dignity of the United States were at stake. American public opinion had swung swiftly in favor of war. Germany's hostile intentions had been made abundantly clear when a telegram was intercepted on January 16, 1917. In it, the German Foreign Minister Alfred Zimmermann proposed an alliance with Mexico. President Wilson was a peace-loving man, reluctant to commit American money and American lives to someone else's war. But the Great War had now become America's problem as well. And as the urgency of the situation presented itself, he realized there was but one clear alternative. On April 6, 1917, the United States declared war on Germany.
You're listening to the World War I Living History Project.